Good morning, everyone. Representative Dill and I would like to call this meeting to order since we are having a joint hearing. And this joint hearing is to educate ourselves about some issues that we expect that will be coming up next year and issues that we expect can take have some decent conversations this summer and coming fall. So with that and with the notion in mind that this is an educational opportunity, we're going to start with the history, or let's ground ourselves in what is going on in wetlands. And I believe David Warrens is going to lead us off here and be very just ground us well. Some folks know the issues well and some folks don't, but let's get started. And I think, members, we have a long agenda and a tight time frame, but my guess is that we should be taking questions as we go, as long as they're sharp and honed in on what we're discussing. Would you agree? You ready?
Ready.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius and members of the committee. My name is David Wirens, the Acting Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. To start us off this morning, as you've indicated, we're going to provide an overview of three programs that all intersect on wetland regulation and wetland protection, that being the Wetland Conservation Act, that's overseen by Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Permit to Mine Program, that's overseen by the Department of Natural Resources, and the Clean Water Act Section 404 program that the Army Corps of Engineers oversees. We're presenting a lot of information, and we don't have a tremendous amount of time, so we'll try and move through things quickly. So if there are questions, please stop us as we go to respond to questions. Because to cover over 20 years of at least Wetland Conservation Act history in a few minutes is a fairly tall order. So first off, the Wetland Conservation Act was enacted back in 1991 after several years of debate over how do we address wetland issues in the state of Minnesota. The concept of known at loss, which really first began under the Clean Water Act, is a key component of the Wetland Conservation Act. As you'll notice here, it's been a subject of frequent legislative debate and changes over its particular life. And in fact, every year there's been debate of one sort or another, but about two-thirds of the years since 1991, there have been changes made to statute that govern the Wetland Conservation Act. The purpose of WACA, the focus is to provide protection and to focus on wetland quantity, quality, and biological diversity. We're referring it here as QQB, just to kind of save on some words. But that's the purpose of it, is to protect the wetlands as they exist in the state of Minnesota today. And again, this comes straight out of statute in terms of providing a no net loss of the quantity, quality, and biological diversity of wetlands. It's to increase the QQB of wetlands by restoring or enhancing diminished or drained wetlands, to avoid impacts. And then the part that we spend most time talking about is where avoidance is not practical or feasible, that those values must be in fact replaced. Going back in 1991, it's important, and is the case with most laws, but I think in WACA, I think more so than many, that it was in fact, it was a compromise amongst many different interests. I think it's fair to say that wetlands were expected to be impacted, thereby the focus on mitigation and replacement, and that it's expected mitigation opportunities were to be provided so that where impacts happen, there'll be opportunities to replace those wetland values someplace else. One other thing that's an important factor of the Wetland Conservation Act and why to have three agencies speak on wetland issues is very appropriate is that back in when it was enacted, the Wetland Conservation Act was intended to work in a coordinated fashion with other programs, you know, not to duplicate where another program is performing wetland oversight. Hence, the Permit to Mine program oversees impacts associated with metallic mining. The Corps of Engineers is involved. We also pay attention to Swamp Buster. We have exemptions to deal with those various issues to minimize the duplication of regulation. The foundation of the wetland conservation, what it's intended to do is to protect and restore the public value of wetlands. And these enumerated functions are pulled directly out of statute, and they include water quality, both surface and groundwater, flood and stormwater retention, public recreation, education, commercial uses, habitat, local augmentation, and carbon sequestration are all functions that must be addressed as wetlands are being restored to compensate for impacts. And now the question is, how does WACA ensure that public values are in fact in place? The key components of the rule, as they're contained within the rule, is it provides for directions on where to replace, where to look for replacement wetlands to offset the impacts. The state is divided up into pre-summit wetland areas based upon a 1981 study that evaluated that particular information to a less than 50% zone, a 50 to 80% zone, and a greater than 8% zone. And depending upon where you are within those areas where the impact occurs, there are different standards that apply to how siting impact happens. We also talk about replacement ratios. How much do you have to replace? If an impact occurs in that northeast part of the state, that's in a greater than 8% part of the state, the base ratio is 1 acre replacement, 20 acre of impact. As you move to the agricultural zone in the southern part of the state, so that's 50%, that base ratio is 2 to 1. And from there, it does in fact go up depending upon other factors that are built into the program. And then it talks about how to replace. What sort of restoration or landscape actions can someone take to offset impacts? And then, of course, you choose when to replace. Do you replace before, during, or after the impact? They're all covered in the context of the program, how it operates. In terms of the rules and requirements, they're based on our understanding of wetland science. They do continually evolve. We work very closely, again, with our partner agencies to ensure we have, to the extent possible, similar requirements. We have to keep in mind that different programs come from different places in state or federal law, but we work hard to have common standards so that it works more efficiently for the regulated public. And again, they evolve and adapt as we learn more about wetlands how to do that particular job better. Something that, of course, you're all very familiar with is one of our real challenges is the diversity in the state of Minnesota. That one of the things we work hard to with the Conservation Act is to be flexible and adaptive to acknowledge the differences that exist across the state, as well as keep up with current science. As science evolves, as you learn more, make sure the program keeps up with that, make sure we're getting really the best addressing of the public value of wetlands that the law is intended to achieve. In terms of how that works, really this diagram just really displays how the program is implemented. The responsibilities of Bowser in the Wetland Conservation Act is we oversee the program, we establish the rules, we manage an appeals process that's set there. We work closely with the DNR on enforcement. That's their primary responsibility. But our main job is working with local governments. We serve on the technical evaluation panel, have staff that advise local decision makers on impacts. We provide training and guidance to their work in implementing the program. Again, at the end of the day, our job is to support local governments. The decisions are made at the local level. And again, key aspects of the program, local decisions with state oversight and coordination. Again, one of our primary jobs, help local governments in making good decisions based upon the requirements of the law, as well as upon good science, and coordinating with other agencies that are involved in these sorts of activities. And really, one of the keys, I think, success points of the program is the technical evaluation panel that is made up of a technical representative of the Soil and Water Conservation District, a technical representative of the local government that administers the program, and then a Bowser representative. All three serve on the technical evaluation panel. And when projects also impact public waters, wetlands, the DNR also has a representative on the TEP as well in those circumstances. Now, the regulatory process, this flowchart lays out in a quick succession how the program operates. One aspect to keep in mind is that Minnesota Statute 1599, commonly referred to as the 60-day rule, does apply to wetland conservation act decisions, and so you have to make a decision within that particular time frame. And you notice at the tail end as well, too, there is an appeal process that if somebody who receives notice of a decision, they have 30 days to appeal that to Bowser, and we have a process there as well to oversee that particular process. For wetland banking, it's a very similar process, a very important part of the Wetland Conservation Act in terms of providing for an efficient and effective way to offset impacts. The key difference here is to acquire an easement. One of the requirements of a wetland bank is to convey an easement to the state of Minnesota, a perpetual easement, on the area that receives wetland credit, so that area is protected in into perpetuity as part of the Wetland Conservation Act. A couple last thoughts to leave you before I turn over to Mr. Richards is one of the things that we certainly see over time is what works best for cooperation among stakeholders within all levels, state and local. And when there's different experience and expertise in reviewing wetland replacement plans, it really helps make sure that the breadth of issues are effectively addressed as part of that review process. So again, that's a very quick overview of the Wetland Conservation Act. And with that, I'll turn over to Jess to...
But before you turn it over, you talked about current science. Mm-hmm. What is the state of current science and wetlands? I mean, how good are we? How well do we understand wetlands, and how well do we understand what we're doing when we replace them and replace the function?
In terms of the current science, what it tells us is the surest way to maximize wetland quality and a long-term functioning wetland is to really focus first on the siting and replace a wetland. Is to go into a site and really to restore what was there is the best way to ensure long term. To go in and try and engineer a certain wetland type on a given site, that's our experience, that doesn't work very well. You're guaranteed that is over time, Mother Nature will turn into what is appropriate for that landscape setting and for the hydrology. And that's a key of the 2009 rule, as well as our current efforts, is really focus on, as is, you know, it all depends upon good site selection. And then building and designing a wetland to correspond to what is appropriate for that particular landscape setting.
And what about the science of the vegetation?
The same applies there as well, too, in terms of the vegetation. We do work very hard to have a diverse plant mix to ensure that we are restoring maximum public value. A diverse plant habitat really does maximize the public values that we're intended to address. And depending upon the wetland type that's a perfect landscape setting, there'll be a different plant and seed mix that's appropriate for that setting as well.
I think that we've had many discussions, at least in finance, about invasive cattails, green canary grass. Are your replaced wetlands in danger of either of those?
Well, Cherokee, one of the biggest challenges is where there are amounts of invasives in a current site or upstream as well. That's one of the main challenges we in fact face, is to minimize the particular invasives. There are techniques that are available to control invasives, but that is one of the biggest challenges, and really again why site selection is important, is you want to look not just at the landscape site, but look at the contributing watershed to determine how much work you have to put into maximizing a diverse plant species that you're going for, and to minimize the potential for invasives kind of overtaking that site over time.
I asked this question because I sit on LCCMR, and I haven't heard any proposals to LCCMR about how we advance the science of wetlands and predictive restoration. So that's just... feels like a missing link here. If you'd want to... Does anybody else have questions? Yes, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I have is going to our testifier has to do with the public value of wetlands. Is I know it's quite a bit on water quality, but I'm wondering how much you take a look at the wetland complexes in charge of water quantity in terms of recharge going to underlying aquifers, and how does that figure into the equation?
Madam Chair and Representative Fisher, you know, that is one of the enumerated functions that replacement ones are required to address is not just quality but quantity as well, as you're referring to, and groundwater is part of that. Certainly what the way to look at to manage that is look at what's in that substrate below the surface level in terms of the ability for water to, you know, seep in and get into it. That certainly is part of the evaluation criteria that's looked at as part of a replacement plan, as well as wetland bank development also.
Follow-up question. Thank you. So would that mean that if somebody's looking at disturbing wetlands that are unique to helping recharge Wanakfora, you'd make sure that those restorations would occur so that it would still connect into that same aquifer elsewhere?
Madam Chair and Representative Fisher, not necessarily. What we're looking at when it comes to wetland mitigation is to look at the replacement site on the basis of the location and the area and the type, and compare that to the wetland that was in fact impacted. Not all functions are possible to replace at every site, and that's why you want to look at the broadest breadth of public values and wetland functions that are possible at a replacement site. So sometimes you will get good brown water recharge as a function, but not in every case, because again, that substrate will determine the connectivity from the surface to groundwater.
Representative Tor Colson.
I'm over here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Where are you? Oh, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What do we do in the event that we poorly site a wetland? What are the options if we've gone out in the past and selected a spot that's not working well or not working at all? What are the options for the state to divest itself of a poorly sited wetland?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, there are several options we have. We do require that replacement sites be inspected on a periodic basis. And of course, there are two types of replacement. There's project specific that are very case by case, and then there's wetland banks. The wetland banks are an easier story to tell, because the way that operates is that a owner of a bank has to request a deposit of credits over a cycle of time. And if the wetland, if the bank site does not contain the appropriate level functions, they won't get as many credit as they were anticipating on the front end of the particular project. So that's managed on the front end. For the project-specific sites, the options to deal with that one are to go back to the applicant and to have them do further restoration work or find a new site. We can involve DNR enforcement as well, as they're the enforcement of the Wetland Conservation Act, not Mr. Richards so much, but other folks in the DNR that manage enforcement. So we do inspect and monitor, and we do take action as appropriate depending upon the status of the site.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, in some cases it's really the agencies involved that didn't properly manage the siting of this wetland in the first place, and sometimes we as landowners have been in the past required to plant such things as reed canary grass by the government. And so it seems to me the state has some responsibility here, and I'm just wondering how the state addresses its own responsibility for properly siting, having improperly sited wetlands in the past.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, if you're referring to wetlands that are restored under the Wetland Conservation Act, or just kind of or restorations that happen under like RIM and other sorts of programs, or you're talking everything there?
Talking in very general terms.
Very general terms. Well, certainly we have to take into consideration the history of a given site in terms of what's the appropriate action to take. And certainly, you know, one of our responsibilities at Bowser is the local rural weather replacement program. We are the applicant for projects, and we certainly take a different approach to those because we have a more direct responsibility in terms of how effective any given site is in terms of providing its wetland functions. But certainly, the program works best again when there's cooperation, as seen in the slide here, and that applies to how we manage sites long term in the future as well too. And one of our goals is to acknowledge that sometimes we have to do more than we legally speaking necessarily have to do. If you look at the requirements of the various programs, and we do take those actions sometimes. It becomes very case by case, quite honestly, how we deal with those situations.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the frustrations for landowners is that the rules seem to be changing over time, and that does make it very difficult to make sure that you are in compliance and that wetlands actually are beneficial. Thank you.
Well, we do hope we learn things over time. Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jess Richards. I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the Department of Natural Resources. And as you all know, the DNR is the designated authority for all things related to the permit to mine. And this includes implementation of the Wetland Conservation Act requirements for all things related to impacts or mitigation related to mining. As we've discussed previously, The permit to mine covers everything from operation and closure of a mine and is continually updated throughout the life and progression of a mine. The key difference between a traditional project that's regulated under the Wetland Conservation Act and one that's associated with a permit to mine is time. Traditional projects may span a construction season like a shopping mall or a few years like a major highway project, but a project under a permit to mine spans decades and requires years of advanced planning and changes as the evaluation of the ore deposit is determined over time as well. Wetland impacts under wetland impacts and mitigation under a permit to mine follow the same standards as any other Wetland Conservation Act project. It ranges from avoiding or minimizing impacts to the extent possible, restoring some wetlands on site, and generating replacement mitigation credits off site. Mining companies take actions to avoid wetland impacts in things like their design and placement of waste rock stockpiles. And restoration at closure is also a part of reclamation. But the quality ore at a mine is where it is, and you can't simply relocate a mine. And because of this, there has been and will continue to be impacts and mitigation needs related to mining. The procedures required by law to evaluate this are those dictated through the permit to mine process. And usually this involves some sort of amendment to the permit to mine. It also involves an appeals process that's associated with the permit to mine. The key with wetland mitigation under a permit to mine is that the wetlands that are created can only be used for mining impacts related to a permit to mine. So in other words, if they're handled by the permit to mine process, they can't be later sold as credits to other parties. So essentially, the way it works is like this. A mining company submits an application, and then
Richard, I have a question just on that last point you said. You said it has to be only used for a permit to mine. Can a wetland credit generated by one mine be used in another mine then, under another permit for mine? So let's just a hypothetical that the Oliver uses it to for Cliffs or sells it to Cliffs. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, members, the approval of the mitigation credits would be specific to a permit to mine that is designated towards a mine or a company's mine. So Cliffs, for example, may have multiple permits to mine, but that approval would include listing those specific permits to mine. If they were to want to transfer those permits to someone else, then that's a permit amendment that would allow that. But they couldn't sell it on the open market like a bank.
Thank you.
As I said, the mining company submits an application with the proposed impacts and proposed mitigation. We send that information out to a technical evaluation panel for review. We make an assessment of whether it meets the principles and standards of the Wetland Conservation Act, require changes if needed, and then ultimately the commissioner would decide whether to approve or deny the proposed project. If a decision is appealed, it follows the permit to mine appeal process, which includes an appeal to the commissioner, and then ultimately to an administrative law judge if the appeal criteria are met. Over the years, the DNR has made adjustments to our process to maintain some...
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Who determines if the criteria are met in an appeals?
Madam Chair, members, the DNR will determine whether the criteria are met through looking at state statute.
Excuse me, follow up on that. DNR makes the determination whether somebody can appeal a DNR decision?
Madam Chair, members, the statutes related to the permit to mine have specific provisions for appeal, and it depends on if you're talking about iron mining or potentially non-ferrous mining. It's a little bit different. But with iron mining, you, in order to appeal, you need to have standing. And standing means that you need to be either a property owner who's directly affected by the permit to mine, or you need to be a state, local, or federal government that has authorities that are affected by the permit to mine. In that case, then, if you appeal, then you automatically are granted an appeal. You're automatically granted an ALJ contested case hearing.
When you talk about property owner, are you talking about people who physically own the land, or are you talking about owners next door whose water or wetland could be impacted?
Madam Chair, I don't know the case law on it. However, generally it's property owners who own the piece of land, but I haven't seen whether there's been case law on whether water affected from downstream or something like that might be a property owner as well. I don't know.
That's a major question. Okay. Do you want to, Representative Erickson, did you have a follow-up?
No, that pretty much took care of it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, over the years, the DNR has made some adjustments to our process to maintain some consistency with the approach for wetland decisions with that of the Board of Water and Soil Resource process. So, for example, we utilize a similar set of documents as Bowser, and we also utilize the technical evaluation panels in both the areas of impact as well as the area of mitigation if it happens to be a different county. As part of our work undertaken as a result of the governor's executive order on wetlands in 2012, we convened stakeholders to discuss permit-to-mine procedures. This group represented representatives from the DNR, Bowser, the Pollution Control Agency, the Corps of Engineers, Aiken County, St. Louis County, Lake of the Woods County, a couple different mining companies, and some environmental group interests as well. As a result, we've increased our notification procedures related to wetland issues related to a permit to mine. And we also hired, as a result of these conversations, we hired a new staff person at the DNR, and she comes to us with 13 years of Wetland Conservation Act experience at both the local government level and the Soil and Water Conservation District level, and she's a certified wetland delineator. As we move forward, we'll be taking additional efforts to reach out to local governments as well and to better understand their needs. To this end, we'll be engaging in some meetings later this month. And we're also looking for ways to increase the transparency of our wetland credit accounting system. We have a good system for tracking credits, but we're examining ways to join that information with the Bowser system, or at a minimum, make that information more available outwardly. We're meeting with Bowser in actually about a week to try to work through some of the ideas that we're thinking about. And we'll also continue to make efforts to help educate folks on the appeals process related to a permit to mine. Lastly, I just want to say that we are interested in looking for new ways to handle wetland mitigation needs of northeastern Minnesota. We've been very active in the northeastern Minnesota wetland mitigation strategy effort, which you'll hear about in a minute. And, through careful consideration of local environmental impacts, the statewide wetland priorities, and the economics of wetland mitigation, I think we're hopeful that we can really get to a place where we can achieve some new options that have broad support and are good for Minnesota. And with that, if there's any other questions, I'll take those. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Tim.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe you covered this. I had to be in another committee, but with a wetland that's mitigated through a permit to mine, do those have public access? For example, could they be open for hunting?
Madam Chair, members, it depends on what ultimately happens to that wetland. In some cases, those are still held privately for many, many years, and they may not have public access, but ultimately, there are some that end up being converted into a wildlife management area, for example, in which case they would have private access.
Madam Chair, would that be a condition of the contract relating to the permit mine, or would it be and the wetland mitigation, or is it on a case-by-case basis, or is there some general law that relates to that?
Madam Chair, members, I don't have the specifics on which ones have been that way, but I believe it tends to be on a case-by-case basis, but ultimately, if it becomes state land, it would be accessible.
And then finally, so if you had a contract with, or in the contract it had public access, say its availability to open for hunting or snowmobiling or whatever, I think the transparency issue is really important. So, again, maybe you covered this, but do you have a website that lists the locations of the restored wetlands through mitigation?
Madam Chair, members, we don't right now, and we do need to. And what we're looking at is The Bowser system has a very outward-facing credit accounting system, and we have a database, and we've got all the information, but it's not outward. And so we're trying to look and see if we can feed ours into Bowser's so that it's all in one place. Otherwise, if we can't do that, we're going to have to find a better way to do it with our own website and get it outside.
That's your final question. Would you be able to break down, for example, how many acres there are in a county or even a township now, even if you don't have a website with locations? Can you get a summary data? Is that possible?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes, we can get summary data.
I wasn't understanding when you were talking about some of these lands will be in private. Can I assume that these have permanent easements on them, perpetual easements?
Madam Chair, members, many of the sites will have perpetual easements on them, or they'll have a deed restriction. And so there's a lengthy process that's gone through to figure out the legalities of a deed restriction that would go in place basically to make sure that they can't be created into anything besides what they are intended to be. And so whether or not they're public access or not, it depends on ultimately then if it becomes state land or federal land or something like that. But they need to have a deed holder and a conservation easement holder in order to go forward.
What I'm thinking about is whether this wetland that's held in private hands maintains the function of a wetland forever. I mean, that's the point here. So how does that work?
Madam Chair, members, with respect to a permit to mine, the permittee is on the hook for as long as they're around. And so we haven't had a permit to mine close at this point that's had wetland mitigation sites before. But we do have a deed restriction in place for any wetland-related site related to a permit to mine. So it's a deed restriction at the county level. And I may not be getting to the kind of depth that you want, and I could probably get that for you if you'd like.
I think we need to, as a committee, as we're going forward, we need to understand that. So, Representative Oakley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rather simple question. I believe I heard you say earlier in your presentation that a permit to mine could require decades of processing and things. And my question is, why in the world would it take decades? It seems that most business decisions are done a lot quicker than that. Could you expand on that for me, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members, when a company applies for a permit to mine, they define a mining area. And as part of that permit, they then will slowly develop their mine plan as well. So what happens is that they might start mining ore in one area, and as they actually get into the ore, they recognize that they want to go a little bit farther to the east or something like that. And that's because of the quality of the ore, the type of the ore, grade. They're constantly adjusting their mine plan all within one permit to mine boundary. And so at the beginning of a permit to mine action, they may not know that they're going to impact this wetland over here or this wetland over here, but they know that they're going to have some wetland impacts. And so as they define their path, that's when they, on a yearly basis, update their mine plan and update what their actual specifics are going to be. Does that help?
Madam Chair. Yes, that does help. So what you're saying here is it's an evolving process based on the requests of the mine and all that. So I guess I can understand that. My concern is, of course, the lead times that it takes for some of these businesses, because I think it's pretty well known we're not a very business-friendly state. And what I was looking for is there a way where, and I'm hoping that you guys are always trying to be more efficient and get these processes and permitting done quicker and have real deadlines so it doesn't drag on. Are you doing that right now?
Madam Chair, members, we are coordinating probably better than we ever have before with our sister agencies related to mining permits. You know, that is a benefit not only for the environmental conditions that are placed on a mine permit, but also for time. And that coordination starts on the front end very early, to determine what the critical path issues are to understand the possible permitting path for a mining operation. Through the governor's mining sub-cabinet, they oversee overall the operations of all state agencies related to a mine permit. There's about 21 different permits that might be required for a new mine, for example. And so it's really the key to timing is coordination.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Hill, and then we will move on to Mr. Smith.
My question is related to Representative Uglum. How many issues have there been along the way in this transformation of a permit to mine, the adjustments, the mid-course adjustments you're talking to? How much delay? Is it difficult for the mines? Does it slow them down? Is it working well? I understand you're having a great amount of coordination and all the things you said, but how much of a real problem is that ultimately at the end when in the scope of their plan they got a wetland east, a wetland west, and they decide they want to go west? Does that delay them? How does that characterize that for me?
Madam Chair, members, the mine permitting process is fairly unique to each mine. And if they're a new mine, for example, they would go through an environmental impact statement, and that's a lengthy process, as we've seen with some of our recent activities. And then they'd also go through the permitting process. If they're one of the existing facilities, it depends on how big of an expansion. So if they trigger a mandatory threshold for environmental review, that adds time. The big thing that's important for the mining companies is that they have some predictability of the ability to get, say, for example, mitigation credits. And they will start that process many, many years in advance of requesting a change to their mine plan or even getting close to an impact. So I know Cliffs Natural Resources started their most recent work back in 2007 with the anticipation that they might be needing it sometime in the next few years.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Tim Smith. I'm the Technical Services Section Chief with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers St. Paul District. I'm also the Minnesota Program Manager for our regulatory program in Minnesota. I'd like to start by thanking you for the opportunity to share some information about our program with you and the committee, and acknowledge on behalf of the Corps of Engineers that we appreciate the concern about compensatory mitigation, particularly in Northeast Minnesota, and we acknowledge that we have a role in this process as a federal agency responsible for implementing regulatory programs under two federal laws. What I'd like to do today is talk to you about our program and what we regulate, and then focus specifically on compensatory mitigation. Our program mission is to protect and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters, which includes wetlands. We do this by balancing economic development and protection of those aquatic resources. And I should say we, through implementation of our permitting programs, regulate more than just wetlands. We regulate waters in the United States, which includes lakes, rivers, streams, and wetlands. We accomplish this primarily through two federal laws. Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 and Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, which was passed in 1972. I'll talk about each of these briefly and give you some background information on those. Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 requires permits for activities that may obstruct or alter navigable waters. Navigable waters are generally thought of as being those highways of commerce. This primarily comes from an area where we use those highways of commerce to transport goods and services. Largely that business has been replaced by rail and truck traffic, but we still maintain our permitting program to protect those federal navigable waterways. Activities commonly requiring permits in navigable waters, excavation, dredging, depositing material, really any activity over, under, or in a navigable water that could affect the navigable capacity of that waterway. Navigable waters are defined as those in the first part there, subject to the ebb and flow of the tide. Those are generally in our coastal areas of the country. What we see primarily in Minnesota are those that have been or could be used in the future for use to transport interstate or foreign commerce. And that's our nexus under the Commerce Clause to regulate those activities. And then we maintain a list of those navigable waters in Minnesota on our webpage, and those are a very discreet list, and they require approval beyond the St. Paul District to add or remove waterways from that list. Under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, we regulate discharges of dredged or fill material into waters of the United States. waters of the United States is somewhat of a controversial topic today in terms of what exactly constitutes a water of the United States, and there is a proposed rule to redefine what is a water of the United States right now that was just noticed and is open for public comment. In terms of this particular part of the Clean Water Act, fill material is any material that replaces a water with dry land or raises the bottom elevation of a water of the United States. It's an effect-based determination whether or not there was a discharge of fill material. And a discharge of dredge material is really any addition of dredge material to a water of the United States, excluding incidental fallback.
Representative Kahn?
Could you give an example of what are waters of the United States in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representatives?
Mississippi
River is an obvious one. I would say if you have a perennial tributary to the Mississippi River, that would clearly be a water of the United States. If you had a wetland that abuts a perennial tributary to a navigable water, that is clearly a water of the United States. Generally, the areas of dispute are those as you move further and further away from navigable waters and get up into the upper reaches of watersheds. The decisions on whether or not those are waters of the United States are more fact-specific and require much more investigation.
Representative Cox.
And we see Lake Superior, and what about the rivers that go into Lake Superior, and also the Minnesota River? Are those?
Madam Chair, members, yes, those are clearly waters of the United States. Lake Superior obviously is a both a traditional navigable water, and therefore is specifically identified those type waters under our regulations and in statute as waters of the United States. And then those direct tributaries to those navigable waters and things like the Mississippi River, yes, those are clearly waters of the United States.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So waters of the United States could be broadly defined as anything that is in the Mississippi River watershed, would could potentially be considered waters of the United States?
Madam Chair, members, no, I think that's kind of an oversimplification of the jurisdictional determination. So just being in the watershed itself does not necessarily mean it is subject to our jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. As I mentioned earlier, as you move further and further away from the Mississippi River and you get into what we call headwater areas, where you may not have perennial streams and the connection between the wetland or the stream and the navigable water is a bit more tenuous, those are fact-specific determinations that, like I said, require some investigation to be able to make a determination.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But potentially any mitigation site, whether it's up in mining mitigation or, for instance, Lake of the Woods County, would ultimately have to go through your agency, first of all, to find out then if it was in this waters of the United States, which would put the Corps of Engineers ultimately in charge or the main decision maker in any of that process. Would that be a correct statement?
Madam Chair, members, if you're referring to a mitigation site, what we typically look at for mitigation sites, since the In the case of a bank site, let's say, if that bank was going to be used to provide mitigation for impacts to the waters of the United States, that would be our nexus for reviewing that proposal. So the jurisdictional component of that is not as important. So we would look at that bank site and try to make a determination on whether or not it met our criteria for restoring functions and values of wetlands. We have incorporated into our process a requirement for our staff to do jurisdictional determinations for wetlands or bank sites so that we can understand whether or not those wetlands that were created would be subject to our jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. But when primarily we're looking at bank sites or mitigation sites, we're really our nexus for being involved in those is an applicant proposing those as mitigation to offset unavoidable impacts through our permits.
We'll take one more question now, Representative
Russo. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's complicated in this area where the mining is being considered because it's close to the triple watershed boundary. Things drain to Superior or the Mississippi or the Hudson Bay. Although the current, the PolyMet proposal in particular drains to Lake Superior, the immediate area where the mining's taking place. So it would be useful for us to get a better sense of how far back that, and I realize you can't, you know, rule on it without looking at the specifics. But in that area, what we've got Lake Superior, we've got the St. Louis River that empties into Lake Superior, and then the Embarrass River and the Partridge River that are in question up by the mine are go into the St. Louis River. So is it more or less likely, you know, are they likely to be within the jurisdiction? Somewhat unlikely. I mean, I know you might not want to pin it down, but I'm just trying to get a feel for what we need to consider.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not familiar with the jurisdictional determination that's been done for the PolyMet project. My understanding is that the majority of the wetlands and aquatic resources that would be impacted by that project are subject to our jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian, and I want to move, I'm watching the clock, so Representative Fabian will have this last question, and I want you to finish up so we can move on to the Williams Creek discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe we can, Mr. Smith, I appreciate you being here. I represent Northwest Minnesota, and I know this is a little bit out of what we're talking about today, but we have talked extensively about the 404 permit. I have many, many concerns about the lack of efficiency within the Army Corps of Engineers with regards to getting permits issued for simple road projects, county gravel roads that are going to just be reshaped a little bit, making the roads safer so the banks aren't so steep, not going outside of the right-of-ways, and it can take 2, 3, 4 years to get these permits. It adds hundreds of thousands of dollars of expense to these. And quite frankly, in the discussions that I've had, even with Senator Franken's office, there's a tremendous amount of frustration in the foot dragging and the lack of efficiency within the agency when it comes to issuing these permits. So, Madam Chair, I'll let that go for now, but I want to get that on the record because this is a huge concern in rural Minnesota, particularly when you're trying to move water in an area where you have maybe 3 inches of slope per mile, as opposed to some of the areas in Representative Dill's district where you've got 30 or 40 feet per mile. And it's extremely frustrating. I hope that your agency will work to solve some of these problems.
I think what the purpose of this hearing is to raise issues, not make sure all the issues are on the table so that as we go forward in the summertime and in the fall, folks are working together to resolve them. So I don't think we have to answer every issue now, but we do have to have them all on the table, and that's it's now on the table.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Be quick about wrapping up.
Okay. Let me move on to then talking about mitigation under our program, which is very similar in form and process to what is done under the Wetland Conservation Act. At the core, our permitting process, we have a sequencing requirement to avoid, minimize, rectify, reduce, and then finally compensate for impacts to aquatic resources. That's very similar to what the state does. There's a lot of overlap there. Compensatory mitigation, as I mentioned, is the final step, and the goal there is to restore, establish, enhance, or preserve aquatic resources to offset those impacts that we permit. As I mentioned, the applicant must first demonstrate that they've avoided and minimized to the greatest extent practicable before we get to compensatory mitigation. And why is compensatory mitigation required when we get to that final step? Well, we need to make sure that the permitted activity is not contrary to the public interest, which is a requirement under our program, and it's very similar to the requirement under the Wetland Conservation Act. We also have to demonstrate compliance with applicable federal laws, which includes the Clean Water Act and the National Environmental Policy Act. And then our program has similar to other agencies in the federal government, we need to collectively contribute to a national goal of no overall net loss of wetlands. It's not a goal that we necessarily have to achieve ourselves, but as a federal government, that is how we're looking at our combined efforts. How we implement mitigation: in 2008, we passed the federal mitigation rule, which really lays out the standards and requirements for compensatory mitigation under the 404 program, addresses where and how compensatory mitigation is done, and it covers mitigation banks, in-lieu fee programs, and what we refer to as permittee responsible mitigation. The fundamental premise behind the federal mitigation rule is a watershed approach to compensatory mitigation, meaning we need to look at maintaining those systems in those watersheds where the impacts occur and try to replace those lost functions within that watershed, with the ultimate goal of sustaining the performance or the value provided by the watershed and the aquatic resources contained therein. We have published in the St. Paul District our guidelines for implementing the federal mitigation rule. We've worked very collaboratively with the public and our state partners in development of this, and there's a lot of similarities between how we're approaching mitigation and how it's handled under the state's programs. We continue to have those discussions about maintaining that continuity between the respective programs for efficiency of implementation, also for the benefit of the public. And just some things that we're working on collectively right now, we do share positions with the Board of Water and Soil Resources to implement the mitigation banking program, where the Corps funds part of a position over at Bowser, and that person sits in the Bowser office a couple days a week and sits in our office a couple days a week to help us make sure that we're coordinating our efforts on mitigation banking and tracking activity in mitigation banking. Last fall, we also signed a memorandum of understanding with the Board of Water and Soil Resources to further coordinate our efforts in mitigation banking and improve consistency between the two programs. And then finally, what you'll hear about next is the joint interagency report on the siting of wetland mitigation in northeastern Minnesota, which we were a co-author and represented some of our other federal partners on that panel. If there are no other questions, I'll hand it off to Mr. Wyman.
As you're going through this, we can read, so don't just hit the highlights of what is going on. Just give us an outline of what's going on, and we will be reading because we can read faster than you can talk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try and cruise through this fairly quickly in the interest of time. You have a lengthy PowerPoint in front of you. The full report is available on the Bowser website as well. I'd encourage you to access that and read it. We view this report as really our roadmap to addressing a lot of the concerns that have been evident in northeast Minnesota, really since the enactment of wetland conservation. We've been addressing these particular issues. So with that, let's jump into it. This has been a coordinated approach involving Bowser, DNR, PCA, the Corps of Engineers, and the EPA are also all involved in the program on this particular project. The areas that we are focusing our attention on really are those two northeast wetland bank service areas, and these are the major basins. Lake Superior is number one, and the Rainy River basin is number two. Those are the main areas of concern, and as was mentioned earlier, a lot of the mining projects, that's some conversation really is along that border between bank service areas one and two. That's part of the complication we're trying to deal with here as well. In terms of the scale of future impacts, I think it's important to understand what the scope we're trying to deal with. The expectation, and I think it's probably a conservative estimate, is over 5,000 acres of impact over the next 20 years. That's the amount of wetland impact we need to try and deal with and are trying to address through this particular project. The problem statement, again, the ongoing and projected impacts are expected to be high. The fact there has not been much impact in the past means there's not a lot of area to restore, making it a challenge to find quality and beneficial mitigation sites. And we think that if we improve our coordination, we think we can result in better public outcomes under the regulatory programs. So in terms of the first area of recommendations that came out of this particular report is talking about the mitigation search criteria. The first one deals with practicability, and that's a sort of a term of art of what does an applicant have to go through to find adequate wetland mitigation in terms of cost, technology, and logistics, and also in terms of the quality of the wetland replacement as well. Those are two main angles that we're trying to address through this and have some better clarity, again, to ensure that we're having efficiency as well as effective replacement of public values. In terms of the alternative options for compensatory mitigation, again, one of the challenges that we face is that there are not a lot of traditional opportunities for mitigation in northeast Minnesota. So we're talking about some really non-traditional, some out-of-the-box thinking. And in fact, the one thing that's important to recognize here are some of these recommendations suggest that we should allow replacement of wetland impacts with non-wetland restoration actions. We'll talk about some of those here in a minute. And that's really, I think, a major change from how we dealt with wetland mitigation over time in the state of Minnesota. The first option is look at preservation, which is currently allowed under the Wetland Conservation Act in the rule. Our suggestion here is to clarify and utilize the existing option more than has currently been the case, but also to expand the scope to allow for the protection of areas that are around headwaters, groundwater recharge areas and the like, that have, again, some public value areas so that we can maximize the watershed benefits of Northeast Minnesota. To skip on to term option number two, talks about restoration, protection of riparian cores and streams. This is one of the options where we do get at if you protect areas around around rivers and streams, they may not necessarily be wetlands, but they do provide watershed benefits for Northeast Minnesota, as they are enumerated here on this particular slide. And we think that those are values that allow us to retain, again, values and functions in Northeast Minnesota instead of exporting them outside of those two bank service areas. And again, the option being is preservation of buffers adjacent to trout streams and other sensitive northeast streams to allow buffer reforestation activities to remove shading. We think they add some value. And then to re-meander channels, turn back to their natural function. It's been very common to channelize streams to straight rivers. Again, the one option here is looking at trout streams, very important in Northeast Minnesota. If the option here that's discussed is if we protect those headwaters, that provides benefits for the trout fishery in those rivers as well as in Lake Superior. And that's, again, one of the additional options being considered here. Again, this idea of channel restoration, a lot of channelization occurred throughout the state. The example here that's talking about, you can see the original channel towards the bottom of the screen. But it's been channelized to run through that dark area. If you were to turn into a natural stream, that would provide function and value for habitat as well as for water quality and water flow. Stabilization of natural hydrology. I think the main issue here is ensuring that wetlands have an appropriate amount of hydrology, amount of water given to a given resource. The concern that comes to play is it's entirely possible to have too much water in a wetland. That affects its ability to provide the full range of public values. The thought process here is if we can stabilize and restore natural hydrology, that will improve the long-term functioning of existing wetlands. Peatland hydrology. There's lots of peatland in north central Minnesota. There's been a lot of ditching that has occurred over time. They've only been partly successful. But they do impact the functioning of the wetland as well as downstream waters as well. And the recommendation here is to allow mitigation credit for restoring peatland hydrology. It requires more function evaluations, more guidance. You see the map here in the screen identifies that the peatland areas and where ditching has in fact occurred. As you see, there's a lot of both going on, lots of peatlands and a lot of ditching that we think provides some restoration of natural function. A new option is to look at watershed plans, to look at local plans and how they might suggest specific actions that provide watershed function benefits that can be used to offset wetland impacts. Some of the ideas that we're talking about there, look at TMDL implementation plans, basin plans, local water plans. There are a variety of plans that are available that can identify specific actions, again, to provide water quality and quantity benefits to Northeast Minnesota. And we think if we provide some encouragement to local governments, we can have some additional benefit to how we manage Northeast Minnesota. Another change looking at wetland siting criteria, as I discussed in the first presentation, one of the key issues is providing direction to applicants on where they should be looking for replacement wetlands. And one of the things that we're looking at in terms of the interagency team that worked on this is we want to maintain incentives to replace wetlands within the watershed impact, but where that's not possible or available is that how we look outside the watershed to maximize the public value. And that's what this is really talking about. If you look on this slide here, items 1, 2, 3, and 5 are within existing law in terms of if you're an applicant, you have to follow in a sequence where you look for replacement wetlands. you know, first on-site, say my watershed, can't find it there, you move out from there. The item that's in yellow or orange on the screen is a new proposal is to be more directive on once you can't find appropriate mitigation within the bank service area is that every process to designate areas that are high priority, we would direct applicants to look for mitigation there as well. Again, some examples of that are looking at.
I got a question. Oh. When you said, thank you. When you said areas of high priority that you're going to establish, does that mean elsewhere in the state outside of bank service 1 and 2?
Madam Chair,
I think it does, but I just want to make sure of that.
Yeah, those areas. They could be within the existing bank service areas, but our thought is we'd be looking statewide for what is the greatest public value for restoring, wetland and watershed function.
Thank you.
And again, one example here is under the Wetland Conservation Act. You see the preset wetland areas on this map. That's the 50% area. It really is designated as a priority area under current rule, as is the prairie pothole area region is also generally thought of as a priority area also. That's generally conforms to a good share of that part of the state. A more specific area is looking at the prairie plan. They've identified specific restoration areas as well too. These are examples of things that we'll look at if this proposal is being implemented. There are some other ideas that probably have a lesser impact but are valuable overall. Is we think if we have a database of potential mitigation sites, it provides some opportunity for applicants to not recreate the wheel every time. They can look at past work done to identify sites. That makes for a more efficient process. We also think that if there's a early agency review, a rapid response team can really help applicants and bank sponsors to kind of move quickly through the process, get some early feedback. And we shouldn't forget that private wetland banking is a very important going concern in the state of Minnesota, and improved focus on that can also help address and meet the mitigation need as well. And there are two other options here for alternative mechanisms for providing potential mitigation. The first one is to establish a Northeast Regional Cooperative. That'd be an umbrella bank to provide wetland, replace the wetlands throughout Minnesota. And an in-lieu fee program is a sort of a term of art that we can go into more detail during questioning if that's desired. The first option here, this came up a few years back as a way for the local entities in Northeast Minnesota to develop a cooperative for wetland mitigation, which is, as the term implies, they work together to provide the wetland mitigation. The other option, the fee program, where again, this is as Mr. Smith indicated, it's allowed under the federal rule, and it's there is some language in the state law as well that addresses this. It's an opportunity to deal with mitigation on a larger scale than project by project. And my last slide is that outcomes of team recommendations. We think if these recommendations are implemented, it'll improve the clarity of agency expectations. It'll provide a broader focus on water quality and overall resource benefits in Northeast Minnesota. It'll improve the targeting of mitigation to high priority areas, again, to focus on that public value. To increase efficiency, sort of across the board for all involved. And again, we believe that mitigation will, that results in a greater public benefit. So that was a very, very quick review. If you want any further discussion here or afterwards, we'd be happy to visit with any member.
Further questions for Mr. Byron? Anybody? All right, thank you. I do have a question. That's the same presentation that we had in the meetings in St. Paul and Discovery Center.
That is correct.
And there haven't been any additions to those presentations. This presentation has no differences. It's exactly the same.
It's not exactly the same. It's been pared down, but all the recommendations are identical to what was in those presentations.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. The next item we're going to take up is the Williams Creek discussion, and it centers around the Williams Creek mitigation site. So if we could have come forward, Mr. Stromlin from Lake of the Woods County. Mr. Pavlik, are you here from Cooch County? I haven't seen you yet. Yeah, and also Brian Napstead of Aiken County. Welcome, and when you begin your testimony, if you'd state your name and address, or state your name and who you represent for the record. And welcome, and we have your, this is the document that we'll be looking at, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members. My name is Josh Strumlin. I'm Lakeland Woods County Land and Water Planning Director. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to relay issues regarding the current process to establish mitigation sites in Minnesota. I appreciate the efforts of all agencies involved and your interest in hearing from Greater Minnesota. The previous presentations have allowed you to understand the current process and what a conceptual process might look like moving forward. I applaud the agencies in recognizing deficiencies and offering reasonable solutions as this process moves forward. Since you've all heard how the process works and conceptual solutions, I would like to take a few moments of your time to relay a real-life experience of how the process has not worked. We can all learn from this experience in order to understand what changes are needed. And at the end, I would like to share some thoughts and recommendations. But before I do that, I want to be very clear that this is not about the act of mining. DNR Lands and Minerals is the experts in that field, and they should be left. That should be left with them.
Okay.
You'll probably hear from me state that several times throughout this discussion today. Since enacted in 1991, the Wetland Conservation Act has been implemented locally with oversight from the Board of Water and Solar Resources. The WACA also outlines a technical evaluation panel, or TEP, roles and responsibilities. Typically, the TEP is comprised of a representative from the local government unit, SWCD, and the Board of Water and Solar Resources. The WACA breaks the state into three distinct areas, less than 50, 50 to 80, and greater than 80%, based upon the pre-settlement wetlands remaining. The greater than 80% areas of the state have approximately 80% of the wetland resources, and due to that reason, just about every project in that portion of the state, wetlands are accounted for. They're impacted. County or SWCD staff deal with the wetlands on a daily basis, and we are the local experts. Our input on projects should be taken seriously. We deal with the land, assist with the landowners, and are knowledgeable about local conditions. Just as DNR Lands and Minerals are experts for the act of mining, we are the local experts. Yet the local experts and the TEP's knowledge about the Williams Creek site has been ignored. The local experts know the site and know the local conditions better than anyone. But in effect, we are being told that we are wrong by people who have little knowledge of the site and even some who have never been to the site. This is a big problem with the current process. None of us would be here today discussing the Williams Creek site if it was an adequate site for wetland mitigation. The TEP, as well as other reviewing agencies, relayed their comments on the suitability and the challenges of the Williams Creek site extremely early in the process. In fact, the TEP provided comments regarding the challenges and risks of the site and advised the applicant against pursuing the site on two separate occasions, well before the applicant acquired the property. Since that time, the county has offered to help find other alternative mitigation sites and even identified an alternative site with a willing landowner that would provide more suitable and beneficial wetland mitigation for a watershed, yet we still have been ignored. Now I'd like to provide you with a PowerPoint presentation that gives you an idea of what information that it is obtained during the process and what we make our decision based upon. In the essence of time, I'll try and quickly move through it for you.
And so you're now going through this document?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
The Williams Creek Mitigation Site presentation. This presentation provides the following information: impact and replacement site locations, historical conditions, changes on the landscape, such as the PL 566 project, public drainage systems, agriculture, and provide a summary and recommendation. The impact and replacement site locations. This slide indicates the approximate locations where most of the mining impacts are occurring in relation to the William Creek site. As you can see, it is outside the bank service area or watershed basin, And I agree with the Northeast Siting Team's approach to in resolving wetland replacement in areas that would have the most public value. However, if wetland replacement is proposed in Lakewood Woods County, we are committed in working with the reviewing agencies and the applicant in identifying a site that will achieve a functional lift and have a public value both locally and from a statewide perspective. Some of the historical conditions and some of the information that we take a look at are the original land survey. There's a soil survey. Original land survey is from 1894, 1895, and that varies throughout the entire state. There is a soil survey, and this one here is a reconnaissance soil survey dated circa 1926. And what this indicates is primarily that crosshatched area was mostly a muck type of soil. And historical aerial photos. This photo is from 1941. You can see that agriculture on the Williams Creek site had already started or commenced prior to 1941. However, if you focus your attention on the eastern side of the picture, agricultural practices have not started. It's very similar, very historical conditions. From the historical information, the site appears to be a good candidate for wetland mitigation. However, again, I had mentioned the PL 566 project. I'll get into that in a little bit. Public drainage systems. Portion of the watershed has been diverted to adjacent watersheds and agricultural production. Conducted on the site prior to 1941. Also, land clearing and burning of the peat at that time was common practice for converting land to agricultural purposes. Also, many of you are probably not aware of this, but we had a great fire of 1910 in Lake of the Woods County that destroyed much of the county itself. And that paved the way, essentially, and making it a lot easier for land to be converted into agricultural production because of the burning of the peat, the willows, the woody vegetation, the trees were basically disintegrated. I'll quickly move through here. Here's the plan that developed the 566 project. It was prepared by the Lakewood Woods SWCD in consultation by the U.S. Department of Ag. And this is right around 1962, 1963 it was developed. Was a major water conveyance project that diverted watershed around the proposed mitigation site. It was a large project at the time, in excess of $3 million by today's dollar value. And it resulted in a ditch that's about 100 feet wide and 10 to 12 feet in depth. This watershed diversion project diverted and channelized a historic watershed around the proposed site. So this PO 566 project divided the Zippo Bay area into two areas for the project. Today we'll just focus on area two, and there's the site location in relation to this. This slide, I know it says a lot, but essentially the red line is it's an interceptor channel that was developed as part of this project, and also the light blue coloration indicates an area of channel improvement. Directly upstream, moving in a westerly direction from the proposed mitigation site, there was improvements done to the channel that eliminated the overland flooding that occurred prior to the project taking place and prior to forcing the channel, that eliminated the overland flooding that occurred prior to the project taking place and prior to forcing the floodwaters into the main channel of the Williams Creek site. Essentially, this cut off the overland flooding that occurred in the northwest part of the proposed mitigation site. As mentioned, and kind of the theme here is the altered hydrology within the watershed. And you can see prior to, and this is the actual creek itself that does feed into the system. And before this major ditch was constructed, that was a major source of hydrology for the site. Kind of expanding the picture a little bit, this is all of the public drainage systems that have been established near the site itself, and the watershed, it's outlined in purple. Kind of gives you a perspective of the mass or the magnitude of the watershed itself. This is an excerpt from the plan itself, and basically it depicts areas of the watershed immediately upstream that have been diverted either primarily out of the Zippel watershed to adjacent watersheds. Comparison, 1941 aerial photo to the 2010 aerial photo. Obviously, as a result of the project going through, the PL-566 project, it made agricultural a lot more easy, a lot more obtainable on that site. Continue on with the changes in the landscape. Obviously, altered natural hydrology, overland flooding, groundwater has been intercepted and channelized around the site. Public drainage systems diverting hydrology to adjacent watersheds and around the site. As I mentioned before, the peat soils have burned because of the 1910 fire and also was a common practice back in the day. The dike berm directs surface water to public drainage system via a system of culverts or sidewater inlets. And the altered natural vegetation, as I mentioned, and the aerial photos have clearly shown that this has been an agricultural prior to 1941. And again, the natural vegetation has been dozed and burned. But what I really want to show is the groundwater influence has been intercepted by the construction of this ditch. There were some repairs that were needed in the late 90s, early 2000s, and these are the photos from that project. The lay of the land is that it is higher on the south, lower on the north, and the kind of the general direction of overland flow and essentially we hope that groundwater will follow that contour is from the south to the north, or to be more exact, from the southwest to the northeast is the general flow. So these ditches where it's intercepting the groundwater, it's indicating that that is on the south side or the south viewpoint of the ditch itself. Again, here's just a couple more photos showing the seeps coming out of the ditch system itself and being intercepted and transported adjacent and around the site. So to wrap things up here as far as this point goes, we have historical conditions. Probably was all wet. There's no doubt about it. That's just our general lay of the land. That's our geology. That's our soils. Current conditions, we're not disputing this. This is actually taken right from the application itself, and it identifies the known wetland areas on the site. This is what they're proposing for restoration. So in comparison of existing proposed, the TEP is still somewhat baffled that how we're going to go from slide on your left to slide on your right, existing proposed, by filling in a couple of shallow drainage systems less than 1 foot in depth without even any consideration of other factors that contribute to the source of hydrology. During this whole process, which has been about 4.5 years, the TEP essentially did their own analysis of the site as far as concept one indicates that, you know, basically if they just impound the water, remove the sidewater inlets, and assuming that there is enough hydrology to fuel the monster, so to speak, bank full would look something similar to concept one. Implementing some standard engineering practices, providing an outfall at a certain elevation. Again, the same assumptions were made that there was enough hydrology to fuel the system. We feel that concept two is a more realistic approach. However, there are some folks within the reviewing agencies that may argue that this project deserves no credit. This slide basically indicates the topography on the land. Each gradation of color indicates a 5 foot interval. So essentially, there's a minimum 10 foot of fall across this 1 mile of property. Or if you want to go from the very extreme southwest to the extreme northeast, you have about 20 feet of fall. summary, there have been numerous comments and rebuttals to this project, but the simple fact that the pre-altered condition of the site encompassed a watershed of approximately 26 square miles, overland flooding occurred, and there was groundwater influence. As proposed, the site will not be restored even reasonably close to pre-altered conditions. After completion of the project, a one-to-one watershed ratio relying solely on capturing precipitation. In general, the degree of restoration equates to the functional gain of a given project. This is why a fully drained site has the potential to achieve maximum credit when it is restored. In the case of Williams Creek, even if successful, the functional gain is limited and we will not achieve adequate restoration for mitigation or to mitigate the losses for fully functional wetlands that are typically lost. Lake of the Woods County has very little prime farmland as compared to the rest of the state. However, this particular piece of property is one of our best. We wouldn't have such an issue with the conversion if we were able to achieve some significant benefits within the watershed. While attending governor's and executive order stakeholder meetings and listening to the discussion that ensued, I firmly believe that we all desire the same thing, and that is good, sound, quality wetland mitigation that adequately replaces the lost functions and public values of an impacted wetland. Lake Woods County understands the functions that wetlands perform and the public value associated with those functions. Clearly, we are not opposed to mitigation, as we have four established banks and several pending, not including Williams Creek. But site selection is essential to establish a wetland mitigation site that is adequate to replace the lost functions and public value. In order to address local, regional, and statewide initiatives, and in this context, local meaning watershed, regional meaning the basin, and statewide initiatives is pretty self-explanatory. Wetland replacement projects need to provide a functional lift to the resource, benefit the receiving waters, and comply with the standards as outlined in the Wetland Conservation Act. During the 2011 legislative session, 103G005, subdivision 10E, was amended to establish a DNR as an LGU for wetland banking projects solely established for wetland impacts under a permit to mine under section 93.481. The intent was to increase flexibility for the DNR and mining companies while also increasing transparency for local governments and other interested parties, as the banking process provides a formal role for the locals and Board of Wild and Soil Resources, or Bowser. But we have documentation that clearly shows that DNR Lands and Minerals staff directed the applicant to change the language in their application so they would not be applying for approval of a wetland bank. The effect of this change is to circumvent the intent of the 2011 legislation. The site would not follow normal WACA wetland banking processes. The more formal role for locals in Bowser is eliminated, and the opportunity to appeal a decision under the Wetland Conservation Act is eliminated. It also increases the long-term risk as it removes the requirement for a permanent conservation easement. All this happened despite the fact that 379 out of the 443 credits approved at the Williams Creek site are designated for undefined future wetland impacts. Because of this, it is still unclear as to what to call the Williams Creek site. Is it project specific or a wetland bank? And if it is not being deposited in the state wetland bank, how are these credits and others similarly approved in the past being tracked? What is the process for oversight? And why is it different for mining than any other project? As I just described, the initial application for the Williams Creek Wetland Bank subsequently was changed to a project-specific replacement plan. However, for the Corps of Engineers process, it remained as a wetland bank. Following an October 12, 2012 site inspection, all parties, including the agencies and the applicant, were present at a discussion where it was agreed that the Williams Creek site would move forward as a wetland bank. The project did move forward as a wetland bank for the Corps process. However, for the state process, it moved forward as a project-specific plan based upon DNR Lands and Minerals staff input. So now we have a site defined as a wetland bank under Section 404 for the Clean Water Act, but being called something different by Lands and Minerals. This inconsistency causes several problems coordinating with the Corps, in addition to circumventing the wetland banking process. There is a conflict of interest that is hidden behind the scenes of the current process. That conflict of interest lies with DNR Lands and Minerals having a vested interest in seeing mining activities occurring. I want to be clear that Lake Woods County is not opposed to mining, as we realize the importance it has to us locally, from a statewide perspective, and global economies. We support mining. We just question whether DNR Lands and Minerals is the most appropriate authority to regulate these off-site mitigation projects. For example, in the most recent notice of decision approving the Williams Creek project, the consultant for the applicant assisted DNR Lands and Minerals in drafting the findings. How can this be interpreted as a subjective decision-making process? How can we assume these projects will receive the same scrutiny as other projects? Although I posed the question of why is there a completely separate process for the approval of off-site wetland mitigation for mining projects that gives authority to DNR Lands and Minerals to oversee all aspects of the mitigation site, when Balzer oversees the implementation of WACA and for other types of projects. We understand that for determining wetland impacts and on-site mitigation specifically to address mining activities, it is appropriate that DNR Lands and Minerals handle these through a permit to mine. However, when the wetland mitigation is located off-site in a different county and many miles away from the mining project that is covered under a permit to mine, this approach doesn't work. Why is the process different for mining than it is for private individuals and all other types of projects? It is clear that the process didn't envision hundreds or even thousands of acres of mitigation moving to different parts of the state without any local approval process. We currently have a process outlined in WACA that works, and it works well. Why don't we use that for these off-site mining mitigation projects? If you're not familiar with what I'm referring to, here's an example of how the normal WACA process currently works.
Okay, we've got about 2 minutes.
I'll wrap it up here, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Okay. A landowner has land in both St. Louis and Lake Woods County. He is proposing to construct a driveway and develop his land in St. Louis County. He makes application for his impacts to St. Louis County and provides a copy of the application to Lake of the Woods County for the project-specific replacement plan. St. Louis County approves the wetland impacts, while Lake of the Woods County approves the mitigation plan and works with the landowner through the construction and monitoring phases of the project. It would make no sense for St. Louis County to be responsible for approving the site restoration plan and overseeing the construction and monitoring on a site they know nothing about and in a completely different county. Same logic applies to DNR Lands and Minerals. In closing, or wrapping up kind of here, to some of the problems we can all read here, so I'll quickly go through these. The full credit allocation, despite lack of hydrologic restoration, equals a no loss of wetland functions and value. Loss of prime farmland with little resource benefits, and this is pertaining to the Williams Creek site and others, for example. Purposeful avoidance of the wetland banking process, local experts, and input ignored, lack of consistency and accountability. Some recommendations to resolve those problems. We have to be able to say no to bad projects, and we have to take initiative to find and promote good ones. Treat off-site wetland mitigation for mining projects same as everybody else in Minnesota. Utilize the local decision-making process in WACA. It works. utilize local experts to help target and design wetland restoration projects. In closing, I'd be happy to discuss the details of this project with any of you at your convenience. The problem with Williams Creek could have been avoided only if the applicant and DNR Lands and Minerals would have listened to the county, the SWCD, and local Bowser staff from the beginning. We agree with and support the recommendation of the Interagency Northeast Siting Team, but those recommendations will not be effective without changes to the current process. It may or may not be too late for Williams Creek project, but we hope that our experience will affect some positive changes for the future. Our natural resources and the public who use them deserve better. Thank you.
Representative Erickson. Okay.
Let me just thank the witness for coming forward. I think we have seen the wetlands issue too narrowly defined, and you have helped us understand that we have to think of it more broadly, and I really appreciate your coming down.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, introduce yourself for the tape. We have limited time here. We have to adjourn at 11 o'clock, and we've got some public testifiers.
Chair McGinnis, committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Brian Knapstad. I'm an Aiken County Commissioner. Under full disclosure, I'm also the Chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources and a member of the Environmental Quality Board. The hat I'm wearing here today is that of an Aiken County Commissioner. What I've been invited here to discuss is how the current implementation of the Wetland Conservation Act has impacted Aiken County. Representative Erickson was so kind as to visit Aiken County last year and tour some of our wetland restoration sites and get a good idea of what we're talking about. I find it necessary to take just a minute to introduce Aiken County itself in order to give you some context for what I'll be discussing as how the implementation of WAC is impacting us. You should have a document. This is what it looks like. There's 8 wetland types that are found in Aiken County in the center of the document, and it gives a brief overview of what Aiken County looks like. I'm not going to read through it. I'm just going to refer to a couple of highlights. Aiken County consists of 1.167 million acres. I'll refer to that as 1.2 million acres. Of that area, about 573,000 of those acres are recognized as wetlands in the National Wetland Inventory. I've got a map here. I'm just going to show it briefly. It's not going to show a lot of detail, but there's only two things you need to see on it is the different colors. You've got blue and you've got white. The blue is wetlands, the white is uplands. As you can see from this, and probably from that distance better than anybody, over about half of our land mass is wetland today. Now, the National Wetland Inventory is a dated document. Our field staff has been involved in wetland analysis in our county for decades, and they place the approximate number of acres of wetland in Aiken County at closer to 726,000 acres. So whether you're looking at the data document of about 50% wetlands or the county estimate of 62% wetlands, I think you get a pretty good idea that Aiken County is a low county and it's got an awful lot of wetlands in it. If you refer to the document, it breaks down the type of wetlands. Those numbers do add up to the 573,000 number, and the 726,000 number is not represented on that picture. Just to further characterize you with Aiken County, we're a larger county. We're the ninth largest county in the state of Minnesota. In terms of the metro area, we would be approximately from Farmington to North Branch, and then cover an area from the St. Croix River over to Lake Minnetonka. That's the approximate size of Aiken County. Just a little further analysis of it, about $3 billion in total property value, and just in comparison to some neighborhoods, I'm sure in the Twin Cities, that's that they're about equivalent. So we're not a high-value county. In addition, we're about 50% public ownership. About 500,000 acres and almost equally split between state administration and county administration is public lands. So just over half of our county is even privately owned. In addition to that, we have about 20,000 acres of federal land that's primarily in the Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge. It's interesting to note that from the information from the Farm Service Agency indicates that in 2013, we had about 29,800 acres of land enrolled in ag programs, and of that, 11,900 was hayland. So we're about a 1.2 million acre county, 28,000 acres enrolled in some sort of ag. It gives you an idea that we don't have very much agriculture going on in our county at all. So I only point that out to share the concerns of Lake of the Woods County, that loss of farmland, and it's tenuous to call it prime farmland in Aiken County, but loss of any farmland is of great concern to us. The fact that we've been dealing with wetlands for a long time is no secret. If you look at the maps that were presented earlier, there's two characteristics of Aiken County that stand out. We are in the 80% area, number one, and number two, we're in Bank Service Area 5. That puts us adjacent to every bank service area in the state other than those in the far southwestern part of the state. That makes us a candidate for wetland restoration eligibility to, well, the bank service area is in the 80% area anyway, and I think what we're talking about here a lot is bank service areas 1 and 2. If you take a look at historically what has occurred in Aiken County, the second page of the handout, I believe it was asked earlier by Chair Wagenius, is there a breakdown of how much wetland restoration has happened throughout the state in various areas? This is a breakdown of what has occurred in Aiken County since the Wetland Conservation Act was enacted. We presently have 6,794 acres of wetlands that have been restored or created in Aiken County as a result of the Wetland Conservation Act. We currently have another 11,277 acres of wetlands that are being considered. Preliminary information has been received. In other words, they're in process of moving in that direction. And then we've had another 17,000 acres of wetlands identified as potential. So we're looking at almost 39,000 acres of wetlands potentially being created in Aiken County. I bring that point up because as we look back to the concept of the Wetland Conservation Act, I've had lengthy conversations with Senator Lessard, who at the time was one of the main promoters of the act. The genesis or the driver behind that was the concern of the loss of the prairie pothole region due to drainage. And the Wetland Conservation Act, one of the intentions, at least according to Senator Lessard, was to correct that situation. When viewing these documents and viewing the outcome of the current implementation of WACA, he's astounded. This was never the intention to place 10, 20, 30,000 acres of wetlands in Aiken County. Now, I will point out, in the note that there are a number of different comments regarding mining impacts. Like Lake of the Woods County, Aiken County supports mining. There are a lot of people employed in Aiken County due to the Iron Range, and it's a great economic driver in our area. We are not here to impugn these projects. We're not here to impugn mining. We're here to support them. And in fact, I think if you look at this document, Aiken County has done more than its fair share to support mining in Minnesota. We bring this document to your attention because it represents a clear loss of public value. And the reason I state that is I'm not going to cover this in detail, but if you look at a couple of the pictures following. The first one, I don't know if they came out in color. I see yours are black and white, so it's probably not going to be very illustrative. However, the top one is a normal type 2 wetland, a type of wetland we have a lot of in Aiken County. The bottom is a restored wetland. I believe questions came up earlier regarding invasive species. I think questions came up earlier about public access. I believe a number of questions came up earlier. Because Aiken County is ground zero to these wetland restorations, we've experienced every one of the questions you've asked. As I sat in the audience, I could have given you Aiken County's answer to each and every one of those questions. At any rate, it doesn't show up very well in the picture, but the bottom picture is a restoration site that's struggling with lamb quarters, reed canary. It's a site that's dealing with some invasive problems. The following picture is simply an illustration of a restoration site treated with chemicals. And then the bottom site, which is an open water wetland, that happens to be a natural wetland. I think it's important to point out that the perception that many people in Minnesota have of the Wetland Conservation Act or wetland restoration is that's what you're getting. You're getting an open water pond with some lily pads and some mallards. And the previous two photos illustrate that that is not the case. What you're generally getting, at least in Aiken County, is a lot of type 2 wetlands, scrub swamps, shrub swamps. The final two documents simply illustrate a pending wetland application. The aerial photo, the map of the farmland, indicates what is similar to that which you saw in Lake of the Woods County. But what's interesting is the photo with the water in it is a photo taken earlier this month. It's covered in water right now, and yet this is going to be a wetland restoration site. Again, it just illustrates some of the concerns of the sites being located in Aiken County and not high priority areas. A question came up earlier about access, and I just want to point out that I believe something unique in Aiken County has occurred as recently as the last year or two. You see that we have some depleted wetland banks in this spreadsheet. We were approached by the DNR as to Aiken County's opinion on the DNR purchasing that land. The land is of no further use to the developer. The credits are gone. This is a private bank. Our land commissioner came to us and said, you know, if we don't support the DNR's acquisition of this, there's a possibility that this land goes tax forfeit because it's of no further value to the developer. Now, I'm not going to suggest that the developer was going to do that. Our land commissioner came to us and said it could be an outcome if we do not support the land being purchased by the DNR. In addition, thanks to the legislature last year, we have received adjustments in PILT payments, but looking at the land going tax forfeit, in Aiken County, that means the taxable value of that property would have been $1.63 an acre. If the DNR purchased it, it falls under DNR acquired land, that's the $5.13 payment. So we're sitting there as Aiken County commissioners saying, well, here we are with a 400-acre farm that used to support a farm family 20, 30 years ago. Their kids went to our schools. The parents shopped in our grocery stores. The farmer had his equipment repaired in town. The land was purchased and put into a wetland restoration. That family is now gone from our town and our schools and their economic activity. The land now is of no longer use to a developer, and we're faced with the challenge of, do we roll the dice and hope that the person keeps it, or do we support the DNR's acquisition? Well, the responsibilities we were unclear of. Who is going to handle the invasive species on that property if it goes tax forfeit? Is that in fact going to become a county responsibility? The choice in this case was easy for us. We simply supported the acquisition. I think many of you know the position many northern counties take with regard to further land acquisitions in their counties, but this one had too many liabilities associated with it not to support the DNR position. The final point I would like to make is public value. I believe it is in the state's interest to get the maximum public value out of every dollar that goes into wetland restoration, whether it's a public dollar or whether it's a private dollar. Getting the maximum benefit to the public is important. If you look at our area, Bank Service Areas 1, 2, and 3, we have abundant wetlands in our areas. And at the same time, there are areas within our bank service areas that have water quality issues. We're very supportive of the Bowser recommendations that would allow some sort of a payment in lieu fee program to be developed in order to allow water quality concerns to be addressed in those areas without the creation of additional wetland. Adding an additional wetland, I've heard estimates that up to 7 to 8%, this is an estimate from an individual at the Pollution Control Agency, saying they believe that somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 8% of wetlands can be impacted in a county before any water quality impacts occur. That may be true, it may not be true. I don't know if it's backed up by scientific analysis. But I can tell you, with the wetland complexes in those areas, we're probably talking about impacting 0.1% over the next 100 years. So why not focus our public and private dollars into areas that gain the greatest public benefit, rather than a wetland restoration perhaps in Aiken County or Bank Service Area 1? Why not take a look at a water quality project that's supported in the county local watershed management county local watershed water plan, or a watershed plan? With that, Mr. Chair, I will curtail my comments and take any questions.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Representative McNamara can help my memory on this, but I, in Aiken County, have we been purchasing land for with outdoor heritage money for habitat restoration? That seems to me we had a tract that we had to go back and change the value on because there was an increase in appraisal because of mitigation. Is that Aiken County or is that a different county?
Well, it very likely could be. We have it's about a 800-acre tract, currently row cropped in corn. The proposal was, I believe, on behalf of Pheasants Forever. They were looking at purchasing that property to become part of a wildlife management area. The property is adjacent to a rare wildlife area that supports lax sharptail habitat. And it was their intention to purchase that property. Our county board looked at that. Ultimately, we didn't have to make a decision because the proposal was withdrawn. However, the property owner clearly has an opportunity there to sell that to a wildlife management area or convert that to wetland restoration, in which case, you know, we view the former acquisition by the DNR to be a, or by the Pheasants Forever to be the superior alternative. There's tourism dollars involved, there's public hunting ability and so on, rather than a wetland restoration, which really has little public value.
Further questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I apologize for being late. Is it Mr. Knapstedt?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Knapstedt, does Aiken County support the idea that we widen the wetland mitigation and potentially reach out farther to where maybe there's a county in a different part of the state that could do a great job instead of making, say, I'll just pick a mining company because we've talked about that, needing to go to Aiken County? What if they could go to a farther out county where we probably have land that would really be great to restore and improve water quality? Does Aiken County, would they support something, initiative like that next year in the legislature?
Aiken County would support an initiative like that. Any initiative that maximizes public value would be of interest to Aiken County. Knowing that we have severe challenges in the Red River Valley, we've got significant challenges in most major areas of the state, there's certainly an opportunity to expend those dollars elsewhere. In addition, I would just point out that another modification we would support to the Wetland Conservation Act is that you saw a map up here earlier that illustrated the 80% areas, the 50% to 80% areas, and then the less than 50% areas. I think it would be very illustrative to the legislature to see that broken down in greater detail. For example, counties that claim to be under 50% may in fact be 4% or 5%. I don't think it's granular enough to be informative to the legislature. Meanwhile, Aiken County, we're probably in the neighborhood of high 90s. Perhaps we'll be the first county to go over 100% of pre-settlement wetlands just due to the fact the restorations are all occurring in our area. And that's, you know, we support conservation. Conservation in Aiken County is important too, but another wetland doesn't enhance conservation in Aiken County. Perhaps a TMDL project on an impaired lake would be better, or a stream bank restoration. Some of the restorations found in the Northeast Wetland Mitigation Strategy developed by Bowser.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're going to have two testifiers because of our time. The first one is going to be St. Louis County Commissioner Jewell. And we are adjourning at 11 o'clock. Session begins at 11.
I think we're going to have extra time. Yes. We're going to track the time when the session actually begins.
Oh, okay. We'll start with Commissioner Jewell.
The old I will pass. I think Commissioner Napstead said much of what I might say. So,
well, thank you, Commissioner Jewell.
We have to have.
Then we'll take Jim Bathke from the MCEA.
We'll keep an eye on the session.
Okay. Well, that's not Jim. Welcome. Or Jill, I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jill Bathke. I'm the natural resource scientist with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I'll just shorten my testimony a bit today because of the time constraints, and I'll just talk about the need to update the Wetland Conservation Act. In 2012, an executive order was signed by Governor Dayton with the goal of supporting and strengthening the state's Wetland Conservation Act. This order states that it's in Minnesota's best interest to achieve no net loss in the quantity, quality, and biological diversity of our state's wetlands. Yet across the state, the success of achieving no net loss has been largely unmonitored. Why is this the case? One of the reasons is the multitude of loopholes written into the Wetland Conservation Act. WCAA contains a large number of exemptions that allow for the draining, filling, or altercation of wetlands with no permits or replacement mitigation. These exemptions are not tracked, so there's no good way to know how successful the state has been in no net loss of wetlands. For wetland projects which require replacement or mitigation, tracking and monitoring of restoration success varies widely across the state and by approving authority. And a statewide system to monitor WCAA exemptions and better assess annual wetland losses and gains does not exist. At a minimum, a wetland impact tracking system should require reporting to Bowser of all exemptions, as well as annual reporting of exemptions by Bowser. Furthermore, if the public is interested in the success of wetland replacement in their watershed or across the state, there is no easy way for them to find that information. For example, if a member of the public has a question on the success of a wetland replacement site approved under a DNR permit to mine, short of going through DNR's records, that person would be unable to answer the question, were the wetlands destroyed at the mine replaced with the same amount of wetlands with similar qualities? This should not be the case. Publicly available information on wetland replacement sites would provide a more comprehensive view of wetland replacement throughout the state and objective data on wetlands gains and losses. In conclusion, it's clear that wetland protection and replacement opportunities in Minnesota must be improved and that the status quo is not working. WCAA must be improved to reduce wetland destruction across the state and better track the loss and replacement of wetlands regardless of the applicant. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy anticipates working with the agencies on the thoughtful consideration of these items and ways in which wetland replacement in the northeastern corner of our state can be implemented in a manner consistent with a watershed approach and protective of the unique and vital wetland habitats of the region. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bathke, is MCEA open to the idea that you would reach out beyond the watershed where you can do a great restoration outside the watershed, and we're having lousy results when we stay inside the watershed? Are you willing to be open to the idea that actually it's about restoration and not about nitpicking the geographic location of exactly where it's going to be located?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, MCA sees a lot of opportunities in the Northeast Mitigation Strategy Report that was agreed upon by the interagency team. A lot of those recommendations also highlighted in-watershed opportunities, such as the in-lieu fee program for in-watershed mitigation. And I think that's something that we should really look at thoroughly before investigating options outside of the watershed, because there are still many opportunities for mitigation, alternative mitigation options within the watershed.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. The only follow-up is, but if you have a better opportunity outside, why wouldn't you like that?
Kathy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we feel that it's important to still address the watershed needs, and there are many water impairments within the St. Louis and Rainy River watersheds that must be addressed before we move outside the watershed.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. That was my question.
All right. Thank you. No further questions. Thank you, Ms. Bathke. Next will be Mr. Botzek. And then following that will be Mr. Ness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We can be brief. Gary Botzek, the Executive Director of Minnesota Conservation Federation. We want to put a face on wetlands. We've talked a lot about bureaucratic messes that we're in here, but what are wetlands? To us hunters and anglers and bird watchers, they are home to a very biodiversified Minnesota. It's the quality of life. That's why we live in Minnesota, because we can hunt and we can fish, we can bird watch. And you go, Tom Peterson, in fact, a lot of us just put a new face on wetlands here in the last week. Tom Peterson was just telling me, he said he found out I got a wetland in my backyard. Well, when you get 4, 5, 6 inches of rain, thank God we have some of these wetlands that are type 1s and 2s or 8s and 9s. They're holding back some of the water. And that's what they're there for. But they're at the same time breeding grounds now for baby ducks and baby geese and birds galore. So I think you've all seen them and are taking pictures of them and putting them on your phone. So let's not throw the wetlands out with the bathwater here, because they're very valuable. We still have 10.6 million acres of wetland in Minnesota. About 19% of our land mass is still wetland. But that's the good news. The other half of the glass that's empty, we lost over half of our pre-settlement wetlands in Minnesota. And whether you're into trout or walleye or northerns or even raising minnows, wetlands are a very important ingredient or a factor in your equation. Whether you're into ducks or geese, turkey, pheasants, deer, muskrat, beaver, crane, grouse or songbirds, they're all related to or from wetlands. So let's be careful. To McNamara's questions, let's be careful before we throw this whole equation out. Lance and I worked on this in the 90s. It needs work. I think the emphasis that when we worked on this was on ag land, was on roads, and was on urbanization. In fact, I think that we probably gave birth to stormwater retention ponds was from the Wetlands Conservation Act. They now count as functional wetlands. Well, you tell me which stormwater retention pond is worth its weight in gold compared to a natural God-made or Mother Nature-made wetland. The functionality of the wetlands is so important. And now when we're talking about water quality and quantity both in Minnesota, we don't have oil in Minnesota. All we have is oil tank cars going across Minnesota. We have water, and people are talking about water, whether it's White Bear Lake or whether it's flooding and 10 inches of rain, what that did to Duluth. And this last flood, we avoided floods this last time around because our wetlands help retain that water. And in fact, it's holding some of that water back as we speak today. So it's not all rushing down the creeks and the streams and into the rivers of and heading for Gulf of Mexico. With that, Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity. And we're open to discussion. We're open to a negotiation this summer. And this act needs to be revisited. As I said, the emphasis was on non-mining projects. The mining industry taconite at that point was pretty much not a part of the equation. I cleared that with Lance before we got up here, and he can echo that. But we need to make this work for the mining industry as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, Mr. Botzek, I just want to make a point, and I think you have. We've got counties where we've drained 99% of the previous wetlands. We certainly have better opportunities in those counties to recreate the wetlands, and we've got examples left and right where we've done that. It helps with flooding, and it raises more ducks. Let's get real. The other thing is we've got examples, and some of the testifiers elaborated to that, of over and over of us trying to build wetlands within adjacent to where we've had to disturb them for a road or something. I can think of two in my district built on top of hills that don't have any water in them today, and we've had 5 inches of rain in the last 10 days, and they're bone dry and full of cottonwoods, where there's counties in other parts of the state where, Mr. Chair, we could do some 2-for-1, 3-for-1. We would really restore and do what everybody wants to do, and I just don't get this saying it's got to be so close. Do we need more examples of bad restoration? Because we have a lot of good examples, and so I hope all the parties we could do some really good work, Mr. Chair. It doesn't matter who's in charge next year. This is something that should get done and be made much better. Thank you.
Mr. Neal.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness, president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. And per Mr. Bocek, we've been working on this since 1986. I'll keep my comments very brief here. I know you're running out of time. But there are four points to a wetland. First of all, they hold water. And some of you know I'm in the swimming pool business. If I told you how hard it is to keep a man-made structure to hold water, much less Mother Nature's own way to hold the water, it's very valuable. While they're holding water, they do certain things. They absorb flood water. They filter our groundwater and our streams and our rivers into our lakes and rivers. And in addition to that, they provide another valuable function. That's the function of habitat. And that's where we all decide that we need frogs and turtles, and we need blackbirds, and we need ducks and geese and deer, and all those things that depend upon those resources for their home, their habitat. So it's really important that we take care of the wetlands we have, and that we are still, to this day, losing wetlands. There's still drainage occurring in many parts of the state, and it's important to regenerate our aquifers. As Gary said, we don't have oil, but we have water. And if you look at other states and across this country, they would die to have our water. They would absolutely love to ship that water to them. They need it that badly. California is bone dry. Other states are bone dry. They would love our water. Yet we continue to send it downstream without trying to save it and conserve it the best way possible. I'll conclude.
Representative McNamara.
No, I'm good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Erickson.
Just a quick question. Are you for moving them out of the watershed or against?
Mr. Nance.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erickson.
We believe that we should put them where we do the best value for the public good. That's what we think. If it's in the southwest and we need to restore wetlands, then we should put wetlands in the southwest. If we need wetlands in the northeast, then we should put wetlands northeast. But where the best public value is.
Thank you. Mr. Tipping. And then next will be Mr. Norton. If you want to come on up, Matt. And we are about 2.5 minutes each.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, my name is Bob Tipping. I'm representative of I'm with Minnesota Geological Survey, University of Minnesota. I'm today speaking for our Minnesota Groundwater Association. And if I can get a PowerPoint up here, I have just three pictures to show you very briefly. Here we go.
Mr. Norton, do you have a PowerPoint?
I do not.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committees. I am just going to speak and offer a couple of comments as a proxy for former Senator Marcus Marsh. Senator Marsh was one of the original authors of the Wetlands Conservation Act. He would very much have liked to have been here today. However, he had a prior engagement. There was a statewide meeting of his church, and he was addressing them on one or another point. But so a couple of comments from former Senator Marsh. First, he asked me to say that as an original author of the bill, he wants to convey to the committee that the requirement that wetland mitigation, restoration for wetlands that are destroyed happen in the same watershed was very intentionally put into the act. It is in the act, he said, in large part because of the scientific and ecological recommendations from the Board of Water and Soil Resources at the time and from the DNR at the time. Replacing wetlands, in the watershed is important because removing wetlands from the hydrology of a watershed generally reduces the function and value available in that watershed for producing clean water, producing a steady supply of water, and producing habitat in that watershed. And so replacing in that watershed is very important. That's where the no net loss is measured. And so the legislature should be careful in in eliminating that or expanding beyond that. Finally, he is interested in being involved in discussions, and he offers his email address and phone number in the event that there are continuing discussions this summer or fall into next session. With that, I would like to just make a quick comment of my own, and that is the concept of efficiency of wetland mitigation for applicants and agencies really needs to be defined better. Efficiency is generally a term that's used with a specific currency of measure. And the currency of measure in the Wetlands Conservation Act is the functions and values of wetlands. Those are supposed to be subject to no net loss, and that loss, again, is measured in the watershed. And while there certainly are many, many wetland restoration opportunities in the southwestern part of the state and the northwestern part of the state, those restoration activities should be paid for with other dollars and not result in the net export of wetlands out of the northeastern part of the state and into other parts of the state. And with that, I conclude my remarks.
Representative McNamara, I think he answered your question up front.
Mr. Chair, I still want to make the comment. I mean, you said it's important that we build the wetlands within the watershed and replace the ones in the watershed. But the reality is, if we took those resources and moved them out the watershed, we could do better for the environment. You need to be realistic. If you stay within the watershed, we have limited opportunities that have consequences. Yes, it would be better if we could keep them in the watershed, but it would be better even yet if we moved them out with the same amount of resources. We could do way more, and we would have our head in the sand if we pretend that keeping them within the watershed is the best policy for the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McNamara. Representative McNamara. Representative Erickson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comment echoes that. We're 200 miles away from the mine, and restoring wetland in Lake of the Woods County really doesn't have an impact of where the wetlands are being used regardless. So I agree with Representative McNamara that there are better places to put this money.
All right. Mr. Tipping, are you ready?
Oh, my comments again, how to best frame this in a short period of time, were strictly generic. And so what I was speaking to was that groundwater component to wetlands is what I wanted to address. And my two points I wanted to make is that with wetlands, groundwater, their occurrence is obviously where water table reaches the land surface. So subsurface materials, what we know about those materials is one factor. The other factor is hydraulic gradient, how water moves through the subsurface. Is it moving up? Or is it moving down? Or is it dependent on where the discharge areas for these wetlands? So the point of my illustrations, again, was to emphasize the fact that groundwater is, wetlands are dependent on groundwater conditions, and where that physical setting is consistent, stays the same, hydraulic gradients within these areas, either up, down, or sideways, can change over time and affect what the wetlands will do and how it'll perform in the future.
Thank you, Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment that in our particular case, because we're in these different watersheds again, in addition to where the wetland would benefit the state of Minnesota the most, it actually has an impact on where it would benefit the United States the most also because of our issues with the Mississippi.
Did I hear a question in there? I didn't think I did. All right. Representative Wilgenius.
You've brought up an issue that I'm just surprised it hasn't been brought up in this discussion, and that is we need to know more about the groundwater and as it relates to wetlands and why nobody has said we need to finish the geologic atlases in the areas where we're going to do replacement wetlands, if it's no matter where it is. So that just seems to be like a big missing piece to me.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have Paula McAbee. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, my name is Paula McAbee, and I'm representing Water Legacy. And I'm going to summarize my comments because I know the time is passing. One other issue that I think we need to address is the impacts of wetlands destruction on local water quality. And that is one of the most important reasons, in addition to water quantity and the preservation of aquifers, why substituting or adding additional watersheds is problematic. In the St. Louis River watershed, one of the issues that's very troubling is downstream water quality, where there are elevated levels of mercury and methylmercury in fish. And 1 out of 10 infants born in the Lake Superior region already have unsafe levels of mercury. So the reason why, first, I think we need to make sure that we're doing a scientific assessment of wetlands functionality. We need to look at both destruction, directly and indirect impacts. And I think even the idea of where are we doing restoration, the closer to the location, I was looking at the Williams Creek and thinking that is not the priority either. The priority has to be looking at what do the wetlands do in that area, and to what extent can they be conserved, preserved, and locally replaced. And the one other point I would suggest, I think MCEA talked about the need for more science. And I think we need to really update not just the public transparency, but update inventories of intact, damaged, and destroyed wetlands in the region, and do better scientific analysis so that we know which functions are being replaced. And finally, I would repeat one comment that I think Mr. Norton mentioned. Water Legacy is not saying that this effort to preserve watersheds in northeast Minnesota is the only public policy priority for Minnesota. It's just that we don't want to sacrifice one zone, and we would hope that the legislature would also consider directing other resources to begin to replace wetlands in areas where the destruction happened 40 or 50 or 100 years ago, when we were not as knowledgeable and careful as we hopefully are today. Thank you.
Anyone have questions?
I want to sum up when we're ready.
All right. Representative, I want to say that I represent Couchiching County, which is maybe the highest amount of pre-settlement wetlands. I'm not positive of that, but it very likely is. And, I mean, this is getting to be an impossible situation the way it's currently being run. I mean, just recently, after over a decade of arguing with the different agencies, we were able to come to an agreement in the city of International Falls how to manage wetlands so that we could build a hospital. And that hospital was going to be built on a man camp that built, that had sewer, water, buildings, and they built the new $1 billion expansion and had also had a riot because of the BE&K situation in International Falls, on a site that was completely developed. But yet, once the man cap was gone, the water and sewer was still there, we still had these huge wetland challenges. I'm not forsaking. I think that there is a tremendous amount of opportunity in St. Louis County alone to do wetland restorations. For example, stream restorations in the legislative district that I represent for trout. But if you think of a wetland the way it is and the wetland being the same somewhere else that's replaced, then we're not getting the job done. We've got to be thinking of a several-pronged strategy, of which I think the working group did, and say that we have these priority areas, but we aren't going to be building new wetlands that are the same as old wetlands within St. Louis County, except where possible. And in Couchiching County, I'm not sure that it's possible at all. And I understand the plight of Lake of the Woods County and Aiken County and those other counties that are feeling the pressure. But let's fix up the rivers and streams. Let's fix the sedimentation. Let's do all of that. But let's also get some bang for the buck out where they need them. And so far, the vast majority of people that have testified here in the last few minutes have said that they don't want to do that, that that isn't their highest priority for this state. And I think that's wrong. And I think that there's three chairs in this room of the environment at this point. Representative McNamara, the former chair of Environment Finance, Representative Wagenius, and myself. And I think the three of us are generally on the same page. So we better sit down, get your pencils out, and start figuring, because something is going to happen after this next election. Representative Wagenius.
Thanks. Just to sum up, you can't solve problems unless you define the problems in the first place. So what I have heard here in this hearing, particularly thanking Representative Erickson for bringing folks down, I've heard issues that were not even talked about in this. So we've got to put all, so we've talked about the issues. Now we've got to write them down, and as we go into this new thing we're getting ready to do, all the issues that are on the table need to be part of the solution. They need to be defined. The other thing I didn't hear anything about besides geologic atlases is we're doing permanent wetland replacement, which I believe we need to do. What's the impact of climate change on any of this? Where's the science here? So we need more science in geologic atlas. We need more science in climate change. And we certainly need more science in restoration. So how are we going to move forward on those three things? So those are my worries.
Any further comments by the members? Being none, hearing is adjourned.